This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQD 89.5, 89.7, 90.7 FM, or online at ksqd.org. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. The legendary musician Alice Gerard is my guest. She's an inductee in the Bluegrass Hall of Fame. She's been a performer for many decades as a solo artist and as part of other groups, most notably half of Hazel and Alice, along with the late Hazel Dickens. And she's just written a book. It's called Custom Made Woman, A Life in Traditional Music. Alice Gerard, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary. It's nice to be here.
I love this book. It's really a treasure trove of photographs and memories. Thank you for writing it.
Yeah, it wasn't my idea to begin with.
I know.
Last thing on my mind.
Whose idea was it?
Well, I was working. I'd been hired for one semester as part of a chair that existed to hire a non-academic person to teach for a semester at Duke. And I was like, no, I don't think so. But a couple of people who were running the place at the time and were friends of mine just kept at me over the course of time. I mean, it was in the back of my brain because they said, why don't you do this? Well, they actually hired me for the job. I took the job after some persuasion. And then during that time, they had all this great equipment in the center that I could use because I was working there. So I decided it was time to start digitizing my black and white negatives that I'd been carrying around for years and years. And so I used their equipment. I'd come in the evenings and date Saturday weekends and stuff. And, you know, people would walk by and see the screen, you know, a picture showing on the computer screen as I was working, and they would comment. And finally, one of them said, I think you should, you know, they comment on the photos periodically. And then one said, I think you should write a book. And I thought, really? No, I don't think so. And then they kept talking to me about it. And then I thought, well, it could be maybe just a book of photographs with stories around the photographs, not an autobiography or anything like this. That was the furthest thing from my mind. And, but then when I took that idea to them, they said, no, you also have to write about yourself. And that was what went on the back burner for a couple more years. that was the last thing on my mind too. And also I was busy, you know, and was touring a fair amount. But then I finally said, well, maybe that would work. And the idea would be, it was kind of what the book turned out to be, not a biography, but kind of a memoir of certain times in my life that were important in terms of the music and my life in the music and stuff like that. And, you know, a fair number of photographs, too. So that's what it ended up being. And it was kind of fun, actually.
Yeah, oh, I'm glad. It's absolutely a beautiful book, and everybody should go get it. I really love it.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, when you were growing up, when did you move toward traditional music? I mean, did you ever have a time when you were like listening to Frank Sinatra or Perry Como or Peggy Lee or whatever?
Definitely. That's what I was listening to. Well, not so much. I don't think of Frank Sinatra. I mean, I certainly knew who they were, but the stuff that drew me in, it was pop music of the day, were people like Rosemary Clooney and songs like Come Out of My House, which was kind of weird and different with that harpsichord in the background.
Yeah.
And Nature Boy, who was it that did that?
Nat King Cole.
Nat King Cole, and the yeah, a couple of things like that.
Yeah.
Few people like that, but I did sort of just listen to generally what everybody else was listening to. It's just that there were a few really good things that happened, and I was drawn to that, so it was a little bit different. But it wasn't really, that's what I was listening to. And of course my parents, well, my mother was a classical musician. She and her sisters all played classical music, and they had this little group called Symphony Sisters Quartet, a high class program of music with comedy.
And they performed,
They did, not a lot, but they did some. Uh-huh. And, I have a poster. and my dad was a singer, although he died when I was young, but still there was a lot of music in my family. So, and one of the things that I took from that is not so much the music, but just the fact that when people came over to visit, they were usually musician friends. You know, my parents had friends who were musicians. And they'd come over and they'd play music just informally together in the living room and have a good time. And I think I took away from that the sense that you didn't have to read music and take piano lessons to learn how to do this. You could just have a good time sitting around playing with your friends. And that was a big takeaway for me, I think. That's how I look at it anyway. Because I would sneak down when I was supposed to be in bed, and I'd sit in the stairs and listen to them having a good time, and they were always playing music. And it was more the good time. Not that I don't love a lot of classical music, but I, you know, I'm not dissing it or anything, but I just think that this was my path to finding more traditional music in the scene of the folk scene that incorporated that, some of that.
What was your first instrument?
It was a guitar.
Yeah, what, do you remember getting your first guitar? Who taught you to play the guitar?
Well, I was at Antioch College at that time, back in I went there in 1953. And it was kind of, it was hippie time. And there were a lot of people, and Antioch was kind of an out there college anyway, compared to, you know, a lot of colleges.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Jeremy. See you later.
Thanks, Jeremy. He's walking the dog.
Yeah, he's walking the dog.
What kind of dog do you have?
She's a rescue sort of pit mix. I got her when she was about 10 months, and she's now about 14, between 14 and 15.
Wow.
And still in great shape.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah, you were at Antioch.
Yeah, and there were people lying around, you know, and I guess it was fall. And when I first got there and I saw them, they were lying under trees. They were sitting around. Some were playing guitars and talking, and they had beards and things. And I thought, oh, this is great. This is really good. I felt much more at home there than I ever did going to Oakland Technical High School, which is where I went, Oakland Tech. And when I, you know, and I had friends who liked this kind of music and folk music, so-called folk music or whatever
Yeah.
So it was all called folk music by us back then. And so I started, you know, learning. I don't remember how I got a guitar, but I did get one somehow. I was teaching myself to play, which is how most people learn to play, is I'm jumping out on a limb here a little bit, but I'll just say in traditional cultures, you learn to sing and play by listening to people around you. It's not necessarily, you know, there's no system of notation as it stands now that would absolutely transcribe music, the music that we play, the traditional sounds of the music, because they just haven't devised it yet. So they might one day, but
they have chords,
you can't really grab onto it deeply by reading it from a book.
Right. You have to play it.
So that's how people learned. And that's how I was learning. I'd say, show me that chord you're using, you know, and they do that. And you know, just give it a try and keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But now you also play banjo and fiddle and what?
I play the banjo. Well, I haven't played it in a long time, but I still have a banjo, and I did recently, and the fiddle a little bit. That was my, the last instrument I was learning.
But do you still,
old time fiddle.
Do you play often now?
Well, at this point, when I lived in Durham, North Carolina, which is where I lived for 35 years, I was playing a lot because there was a huge community there of musicians and lots going on musically in the whole area, Chapel Hill and Durham and Raleigh. And so, and then when I moved back up here, because I lived here for a long time in the 50s and 60s, and there was lots of music around here then, you know, particularly bluegrass music. At that time, we were back in the 50s and 60s, we were enamored of bluegrass and, you know, kind of trying to learn bluegrass music, which was, it's very akin to old time traditional music, at least as it was. And so, so that's what I was doing, you know.
But I mean, do you play your guitar every day or?
Oh, you mean now? Yeah, I try to. I had a couple of bad cuts on my hands recently, so it hampered that a little bit, but they're getting better. So I try to just, you know, even if I'm not gigging or whatever, you know, I try to keep up with it because, you know, as you know, I'm sure, if you're a singer or a player and you don't play and you don't sing, it's harder as you get older to kind of get back into it easily.
Yeah.
You know, so I try to keep it up for that reason. I mean, it's not my favorite thing to sit around by myself and bang on the guitar and sing songs, although I do, but it's not my favorite thing to do. I love playing with other people, you know, not jam other people, but one or two or, you know, and working stuff out. That's my favorite. Collaboration
is what stimulates you as a musician.
Yeah, it really does.
Well, I was a big fan of this record when it came out, Hazel and Alice.
Oh yeah. I love that photograph.
And I love this record. I've always treasured it. And I've had many iterations of it. This is a CD, but I had the
opening. Yeah.
Hello, stranger.
Put your loving hand in mine.
Hello, stranger.
Put your loving hand in mine.
You are a stranger.
And you're a pal of mine.
Get up, rounder.
Let a working girl lay down.
Get up, rounder.
Working girl, lay down.
You are a rounder,
and you're all out and down.
I love the blending of your voices, and I was reading in your book about how Hazel and Alice came to an end, and I was surprised to find that Yoko Ono had nothing to do with the breakup of Hazel and Alice. That's interesting.
What?
But you were talking, because you were just talking about collaborating, that you were talking with Hazel trying to work with her on her singing, and she, was that part of what broke you guys up? She didn't like that you were talking to her about that?
Well, I think it was a lot of things. And I guess did I talk about this in the book at all?
You said that she was off pitch.
Well, she had a problem with being on pitch, which for a lot of, you know, in the larger scheme of things, there were so many things about her singing that kind of it didn't matter that much in some ways.
Yeah.
And it was overlooked a lot. And it wasn't terrible. I mean, it wasn't all the time or anything like this. But mm-hmm. when she and I were singing together, I feel like she was always a little bit higher than was truly comfortable for her. And I was always a little bit lower for me. So that maybe she was less comfortable sometimes up there. But I don't know. This is just guessing.
Yeah.
And so, but when you're just two people singing together, you know, that can become a bigger thing. And I think that's what kind of was happening to me. And nobody had ever said anything to her about it, ever. Not even Mike, my husband back then, Mike Seeger, had, you know, and they played together a lot. And all the people that she played with, nobody had ever said anything to her about it. But I think she sensed there was something. And then, so when I finally talked with her about it, I thought of a woman named Ethel Rame. I don't know she used to be the head of the Penny Whistlers, which was remember the Penny Whistlers? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she was a great singer and she would never have tried to work with somebody and turn them into her or an opera singer or some kind of, she loved Hazel's music. And the thing was, you know, in spite of all this, Hazel, I mean, when I first met her and heard her sing, that was what I wanted to do. You know, I loved her singing. She had so much soulfulness in her singing and power, and it had all the grit that none of the folk singers had in their voices. That wasn't popular in among the folk crowd.
You know, the opposite of Joan Baez, you would say.
Yeah, or Judy Collins or anybody with beautiful voices. But I remember I remember this because it was like, oh my God, seriously? There was a review way back in the first days of our recording. Somebody reviewed, I forget, I don't even remember which record it was, but they said she sounded like a howling banshee. Can you believe that? It was just crazy. So I've never forgotten that. And it's just, it's terrible how cruel people can be. But anyway, I don't know if she ever even saw that review, but she had this strong, incredibly powerful, sort of nail you to the wall kind of voice. It was powerful and gritty, and her singing was full of soul, you know, soul. It was very soulful.
Yeah.
And you don't find that all the time. And you weren't finding it that much in folk singers of the day. And, so anyway, but I think also, you know, I was kind of feeling like, you know, kind of maybe wanted to do some other things because I've always been interested in the aspects of music that surround music, like learning from people and going to their home, you know, documentation. I didn't think of it as documentation at the time, but that kind of thing. And so I wanted to do other things as well. And it was a kind of a bad time, timing, because we were kind of on the cusp of probably becoming even more famous than we. No, yeah. We didn't. I'm just kidding.
No, but I mean, were you when you became a singer? Were you thinking, "Oh, I'll be famous," or "I want to just sing with my friends"?
No, I don't think either of us. Well, I can't speak for Hazel, but my guess is, I mean, she might have secretly harbored some desire in the back of her soul about being a famous country singer,
mm-hmm.
but in her own style. But she, you know, but at the time we sort of settled into singing a lot together. You know, I was having kids. She was working a day job. There was no way we could become career musician. I mean, we could go on the road or do anything like that at that time. So I think really both of us loved the music. And she grew up in a family of who almost all the kids played music of one, you know, to some degree or another. And so she grew up with this. And I think that she was a natural singer, a great singer, an emotional, soulful singer. And when we got together, I mean, the first time I heard her, I mean, my husband at that time, my first husband, Jeremy, met her before I did because he was a old friend of Mike Seeger's. They'd been in high school together, and Mike had introduced him to Hazel, and he told me, he said, there's this little skinny girl. You've got to meet her. She's got a great, she's a little girl, but she's got a great big voice. And, and that was just exactly right. And, so I, you know, I listened to her for a long time before we ever started singing together. I just was kind of in awe of her, the sound of her voice. That was the sound of, that was the kind of voice I liked.
Well, how did you actually become a teen?
Well, I think what people have said, and it's probably true, we used to have music parties all the time when I lived around D.C. It was, everybody was kind of, you know, the people that moved up from the South, when you migrate, you bring your culture with you. And so there was, you know, people were coming up from the South to get jobs around Baltimore and places like that and bringing their music with them. And so there was a lot of, and it was mostly bluegrass music, but the Stoneman family lived up here and there were lots of, you know, hillbillies coming up, living around Baltimore and where you know, music, a lot of them played music. And so there were lots of bars around Baltimore and where there was a bluegrass band and there were country music parks just north of Baltimore and south of D.C. and around D.C., place parks like Watermelon Park, Sunset Park, New River Ranch, where people, country and bluegrass, primarily bluegrass bands, came on Sunday afternoons and played music, and you just go up there and listen all afternoon to the people play. And so there was a lot, and there were a lot of young people like us at the time who were very aware of the strong connection that bluegrass music had to traditional Southern music. And so we loved listening to, there were a lot of bluegrass musicians around. And so we were all kind of, there were a bunch of us all trying to kind of learn how to do this. And every weekend practically there'd be a party at somebody's house where you'd go, and it was looked like in my childhood days when my parents' friends would come over, you know, and it was people, they'd bring their instruments, and it wasn't like a big jam session. It was like three or four people get up and play, and you might have the Bill Clifton songbook sitting on a music stand or something like that, and or words, you know, unless you knew the song. And then, you know, there'd be a singer or two and a banjo player. And, you know, it wasn't like a big jam with everybody doing everything all at once.
Took turns performing.
Yeah, took turns. You know, somebody'd get tired and go get some coffee or whatever, and somebody else would take their place. And that's what we would do all the time. You know, just it was that I think of a party, and it was a music party. Mm-hmm. And this was happening in D.C. It was happening in Baltimore. And probably lots of other places too, New York, Philadelphia. So, and that's where, and Hazel would come. She played the bass. She plays a little guitar too. And I, you know, I listened for a long time. And then I think probably what happened was, why don't you two try singing together? Or just, you see, you guys get and sing. And I was, you know, I wasn't really ready to open my mouth, I don't think, when I first, but I did. Mm-hmm. And Hazel was very sweet. She was a great mentor. And so that's, I think it's probably that way we got together. It was at a party or something like that.
Well, your voices are fantastic together.
Well, it's a joy to sing with another person and try to work out how you get that tight harmony, you know. And your how your to get your voices to blend. I mean, you can sing with anybody, but really listening and getting that, you know, matching voices is a real super important part of harmony singing for sure. So that's what we were doing.
Well, we're talking with Alice Gerard, and she's just written a fabulous book called Custom Made Woman, A Life in Traditional Music. You talked about in your book that amazing thing that brothers and sisters have of harmonizing, and it's kind of a tradition in music from the Andrews sisters, the Beach Boys, the Osborne brothers, whatever.
Yeah,
the Everly totally. Brothers. What do you think accounts for that? Any idea?
I don't have any idea. You might need to ask a geneticist or something. But I think it's very common in families.
Yeah.
I mean, even when you hear, like, the Louvin brothers, even when you hear Charlie separate from Ira Louvin, they have very different sounding voices, but you put them together, and they're just...
It's just one voice.
And it just happens. And it could also be because you grow up with that person. And if you're singing at all, you're probably singing with that person. So you've spent a lot of time singing with them in growing up that way. And maybe that has a lot to do with it too. I don't know.
So were you striving for that kind of connection when you were singing with other people?
All the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think you mentioned in the book that Hazel wasn't as anxious to practice, or you had trouble wrangling her into practicing. Was there a lot of rehearsal?
Well, that's a lie.
Oh, that's not true. Okay.
No, I'll tell you, we had trouble because when I moved away from D.C., for example, she didn't drive. So at that point we were playing a lot, and I moved up to Pennsylvania just north of Baltimore, and the only way she had to get there was to take a bus, or I had to drive in to DC after her work and stuff like that. So it was really difficult, and I had kids, you know, I had stuff to take care of, so I couldn't just hop in a bus and go to DC.
Yeah.
So it was complicated, and so I think what I would have meant was not that she was hesitant to do it, but that it was
harder, logistically harder.
Yeah, at various times.
How much practice did you guys put in? I mean, how many with whatever band you're with? I mean, is it okay? Well, we're getting on stage, and that'll be our practice, or do you rehearse a lot?
I find that if you play on stage a lot, you don't have to rehearse as much. But if you play, say, once a month or something, or if you're playing with somebody different here and somebody different there, you have to, at least I have to practice a lot more than I do. And if I'm playing with a band regularly. And at some point, I think Hazel and I weren't so taken with trying to blend as much as we, because I think we were started to do that sort of naturally after a certain point, but we were working on material, you know, what about this song? Let's try this. How would, you know, and we were not, you know, I was no, you know, I could play the auto harp. I could play the banjo. I wasn't a super duper banjo player or a super duper auto harp player. I was a good backup guitar, but not really a lead player. But we would work out stuff where I could take a little break or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so we were working out stuff all the time and getting material together. And, you know, one time we asked Dick Spotswood, he was a record collector in Washington, D.C., and an old friend, you know, he collected 78 recordings. So, said, maybe you've got something that we would be interested in. He played us Trixie Smith in her down-home syncopator singing Mining Camp Blues. and Louis Armstrong was playing the cornet on it. And it was just this great thing, and we learned that, you know. And then we got a few things off the Harry Smith anthology of...
Yeah, American folk music.
Wonderful, amazing collection. And then we weren't really writing a lot in the beginning, at least not that we ever admitted to one another. We weren't, I wasn't anyway. And, so we weren't really doing original songs that much, at all really during the Folkways phase of things when we were recording for Folkways. But, and then later on, of course, started doing some original material as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, our sources were, you know, very wide. We even tried one at one time to do a Ricky Nelson song. I forget which one it was, but it didn't really come together. But, and we actually did when, Free Dirt Records released the, kitchen tapes or whatever it was, that I found these old reel-to-reel tapes in my closet that, of us practicing. And some of the stuff was really good. One of the things was Merle Haggard's Sing Me Back Home. And it really sounded great, you know, on the, I mean, I think we did a piece of it on the recording. But so, and I had access to a tape recorder, so I'd record the stuff that we were practicing so we could kind of listen back and say, well, that doesn't work too well, or this works better, or whatever. And so, yeah, so, and it was really fun. We had a good time doing that. Yeah. It's a lot of fun to bring stuff into being.
Oh, yeah. And then put it on record. When did you become a recording artist?
Well, I've been told, and I believe he's right, Peter Siegel. Well, no. Yeah. Was it Peter? Yeah, it was Peter. Oh, God. He's great. He lives in New York. He lived in New York then. And we were at a, so the story goes, I had to confer with him before I put it in the book, because I wasn't sure if I had it right, but we both sort of combined memory says that there was this party, music party in DC, and we were there, and Peter had come down with David Grisman, who was also living in New York, to attend a bluegrass festival that they'd heard about in the area. Then it got rained out, so they came to the party. And I don't know how you hear about the party, but somehow the word gets around. And they came to the party, and they heard Hazel and me sort of singing in a little back room. And Peter really liked it, and he said, well, you guys should make a record, something like that. And I don't know. We didn't say no like I did to the book, but we probably said, really? Yeah, so.
I'm interested in the kind of the political aspects of the folk world versus the country or bluegrass world. That is, when you're, we think of the folk musicians as being politically motivated, and you talk a little bit about that in your book, not that they're politically motivated, but they turned their music towards politics, especially in the early 60s. And then we think of bluegrass music, and especially, you know, Nashville country music of that time, as being the kind of opposite political point of view. And like when the Byrds came to Nashville, they were shunned for being long-haired hippies and so on. How did you find yourself navigating between those worlds?
That's a good question. Yes, it was kind of like that. I mean, you didn't see African Americans at the country music parks that I can remember. You didn't. And I'm trying to think it wasn't just the navigation of politics. It was the navigation of that I wasn't from the South. Hazel was. So as Ken Irwin once said, you know, he went trotting around and with Hazel a lot to visit possible recording artists that he might want to record. And she legitimized him because of who she was. So there was that, but that, you know, it wasn't, you know, I don't know. The truth of the matter is there have been, I mean, if you look back on the recorded body of traditional music, and there have always been songs about the condition of lives, you know, hosiery mills things, the hosiery mills, the mills all around, the cotton mills down around. There were hundreds of songs about how bad the conditions were in those, and other mining songs too. And, I think of hearing it more in old time traditional music than I ever did in country music. When I hesitate to generalize because I haven't really thought about that enough.
Sing Me Back Home, that Merle Haggard song you mentioned.
Yeah, but he also wrote Okie from Muskogee.
That's right, yeah.
An interview with him once. He was playing at Watermelon Park, just down from D.C. a little bit. And I went with a friend of mine. We went there. I went to visit him because I wanted to ask him about that song and how it sort of jived with who he was and what and stuff like that. And I was going to write an article for Sing Out about it. I don't know if I ever did. Anyway, it was really interesting to go. And you know, so it's true. I mean, he wrote Okie from Muskogee. He wrote Sing Me Back Home. And then we're not even dealing with racial issues. I mean, the banjo is another. I mean, it's very, people were getting to be much more conscious about the banjo and its place in, I'll tell you that I think Mike Seeger had a lot to do with that in the beginning because he navigated his whole life existed in the Southern, with Southern music. And so he was talking to people all the time and also country music too. So, and he was very, a big proponent of making sure that people knew, because people were not admitting it, that the banjo was an African instrument that was brought over with slavery when people were forced over here. And it's gradually taking hold with the help of a lot of younger African Americans who are playing music these days. So it was kind of a racist society, except for these exceptions like, Leslie Riddle, who was an African American who lived, near the Carter family in Southwest Virginia and hooked up with A.P. Carter to go collecting songs. And I'm sure A.P. did that because it would legitimize him going to visit in the African American communities more than if he went by himself. So I don't know. It's very complex and it's getting better. The IBMA has sort of taken a stand on both women's part, because that's another thing. There were hardly any women playing bluegrass music. There were a lot of women who played and sang music all through the South forever. And not just ballad singers, but banjos and fiddles and things like this, but they just never played out except for very few people, like Cousin Emmy, who had a rough time sometimes because she was a woman traveling on her own, playing for radio stations and things. But so it was women, it was race, you know, and, yeah. And you just hope that at some point you had, you know, some influence on somebody, maybe.
Well, I think you've been.
I mean, there are some, you know, there are people, I think, somebody told me this. There was this popular old-time string band. That's another thing. Well, yeah. And one of the members, they were all from the North. One of the members refused to travel in the South because it was the South. And that's one way of dealing with it. The other way is going on in and
hoping to make a difference.
Hoping to make a difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking with Alice Gerard, legendary singer, songwriter, performer, member of the Bluegrass Hall of Fame. You talk a lot about raising your children when they were young and without any, you had Dr. Spock's book, but other than that, you've dragged them around wherever you went.
I bet a lot of people had that back in the day.
How did they all turn out, your children? What are they doing now?
They're all doing well. Three of them live around here. They were the ones that talked me into coming up, getting, they said, you got to be closer to us so we can help you out more and blah, 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 blah. So finally, I resisted for a long time, but finally I gave in. So here I am. And it's really nice. I mean, yeah, they're doing well. They're older. I mean, it's hard for me. Really? And I talk with my friend Marge, who lives in New York, and she Marge was Mike's first wife, and we've been friends forever. And she had three boys, and whenever we have a family reunion, the kids all sort of get together, and they talk about the way things were for them when they were little. Because in the summers, Mike's kids would come down to visit, so I had seven children. All kind of, you know, young teens down to 7-year-olds or whatever you want. And so, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, they talk about it a lot. One of them lives in Ithaca. Three of them live around here. One lives in Baltimore, two over here near me. So they're doing well.
Oh, that's good to know. So
better than you might expect.
Yeah, you didn't do them any harm by dragging them around.
Reading the book.
my wife's aunt was a woman named Joan Shagan, and therefore she was my aunt also for 45 years or so. And she lived with you. You guys were pals.
She did. She was a really interesting person. I met her through somebody. I mean, the world we lived in was very small, really. Yeah. I mean, the people, like we're talking about this group of people, everybody knew one another. And so Joan, whom we always used to call Shag until she, because she was Joan Shagan was her name, and everybody just called her Shag. And she didn't object until one day she decided we needed to be, more respectful and give her more. So she insisted that we start calling her Joan. And every time we'd say Shag, she'd say Joan. And we finally.
I wish I had known that in her lifetime.
She was a friend. She was not a musician. She loved dogs. She had a dog. She had a cat. She became part of our sort of group of local people. Who knew one another. Joan had gone to the same college as somebody else, and then we got introduced, and she went to all the music events, and she was extremely she really had this very strong curiosity about what made musicians tick. I think. And she was going to be a clinical psychologist, when my husband was killed in an automobile accident in 1964, I moved into D.C. and bought a house. And my cousin, who was a contractor of some sort, it had a basement, and it was suitable to be kind of slightly remodeled to make an apartment. And so he did that, and she, for some reason we thought it would be a great thing for her to live in the basement, in the apartment. And so she did for, I think I moved into there in like 1965 or something like that, and I didn't leave till 1970. So she was there all that time, and she was going to the University of Maryland, and she had her dog, Jubal, and her cat, Jordy. And we all lived there, she in the basement and me on the first and second floor with the kids. And she'd invite them down to dinner. They loved Joan. And she'd invite them down sometimes. She didn't babysit exactly because we were often going to the same things. But she was all, she always kept an eye on things and was very free correcting them on. She'd come down to dinner tomorrow. So they could, and she'd make them sit with proper, you know,
manners,
at the table. You don't reach for the food. You ask, you know, and that kind of stuff. So they remember her very fondly. Yeah. Well, and I do too. I didn't see her in her later years, but we were friends for a long time.
Well, you were saying when you were a kid that you would listen to your parents having a music party and it inspired you. And my wife, whose name is Robin Smith, she's an artist, and she remembers when she was visiting her Aunt Joan, sitting on the stairs and listening to you guys play the music in the same way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I had stairs, right, that went upstairs to the kids' rooms. That's true.
It's great the way it all comes around.
Yeah, it really does.
Well, I'm also interested, you mentioned my Aunt Joan's dogs, and she got into breeding deer hounds. She became like one of the top deer hound people. We used to go to dog shows with her and stuff. But you were into horses and dogs as well, right?
Well, as a kid, I was very into horses. We always had a dog. No matter, can't think of a time I didn't have a dog except at college. And one time when we were on tour for a lot, and my other dog had died and I didn't get another one for that reason. But when I was a kid, I was horse crazy. I was just really, that's all I wanted was a horse. And every Christmas I was disappointed because I would always, you know, be thinking, oh man, this is going to be the year. There'll be a horse standing outside for me. And there never was.
Yeah.
But eventually I got an old nag that was a great horse.
did you ride? Were you a good rider?
Would say so. I mean, we lived out in the country outside of, well, now it's all built up, but it was California. It was, they call it Fremont now, but before then it used to be a whole lot of little towns like Alvarado and Dakota and Centerville and Niles and Irvington. And in between the little towns were all these fields, you know, they had sugar beets and all kinds of stuff. It was near the bay, flatland, and then there were the hills going up next to the flatland. And, and there were ranches. There was a cattle ranch not far, and somehow or other my mother made a connection with that, the people on that ranch, and there was a foreman named Matt. Really nice guy. He and his sister Dorothy, they were Mexicans that had come up to work, and he was kind of like the foreman, and she arranged for me to go over there and just hang out with him every day before I got my horse. And so he showed me all this stuff about how to take care of a horse and ride and get up on the horse and feed the horse and take just everything. And then after I got the horse, you know, I just ride all the time. But I remember one time, it wasn't my horse, but some horse I was on ran away with me.
Mm.
And of course, what the horse did was go into this orchard.
So they could eat.
Yeah. Trying to knock me off of the branch, and finally did. And that's all I remember. I had this big cut on my throat, and I felt like, oh, this is so great. I'm so tough. And I had to take the bus back into Oakland or wherever we were living from out in the country, and I was really proud of my slashed throat. I don't remember how this runaway ended, but it ended, and I and they must have gotten the horse back, but I don't remember.
I wonder if you Alistair Art, I wonder if you saw the Bob Dylan movie with that came out a couple of years ago.
I did.
And what I did. How did you think that captured the folk scene of that era?
Yeah, I thought it did. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I know there's some. Yeah, I think it did.
Yeah.
I just liked the movie a lot. But I don't think I was thinking. It didn't strike me as being out of touch with what was going on.
It seemed familiar. Yeah.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah, I liked it too.
I was there when Dylan went electric.
Were you? You were at that show?
I was. Because I used to, well, we played up there in 1966. And what was it, 65 when Dylan?
Yeah, when he went electric, 65, yeah.
And I think I was up there for some other reason before then.
Well, you were mentioning that Hazel Dickens had an unusual quality to her voice that wasn't like the quality of Joan Baez or Judy Collins. And
right.
I guess to some degree, Bob Dylan was one of the first famous, successful singers who sang in a completely untrained and unsweetened voice.
I don't know where he falls in the succession of those kinds of singers, but that was true. It was his voice. I mean, just, you know, he just was opening his mouth and stuff was coming out.
Yeah.
But it was kind of more about the songs, I think, and maybe his style a little bit. It was kind of cool.
So did that kind of open doors for more unusual voices, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, Hazel had that kind of voice, but so did a number of other women singers who were traditional singers. And this was the high, lonesome sound.
Mm.
And there were guys that had that sound, too. Roscoe Holcomb, Bill Monroe, Ralph Stanley. It's high. It's very – it's edgy. It's not soft and breathy. And it just is – it's powerful. And you can hear it a lot in traditional singing. And so I don't think it's unusual. But it wasn't what, you know, people thought, generally speaking, of was pretty. You know, pretty. I got right. quotes around.
Yeah.
Pretty. You know, and a lot of people just didn't like that sound. It was too gritty, too... It's like sometimes maybe fingernails on a blackboard to a lot of people, but it was highly prized in the know people's circles.
Right. It wasn't Kate Smith or whatever. Well, one of my favorite.
With Kate Smith?
No, she's great. I love Kate Smith.
Yeah,
but it's a different, very different.
I know, but it was, yes, you're right.
Oh, one of my favorite records of yours, Alistair Art, is this one called Follow the Music. I love this particular record.
Oh, I'm glad you like it. That was the Grammy nominated.
Yeah.
Forgotten, can no longer see. My eyes have gone blind, my soul can't feel the love. Once had, like a bird falling down, once gliding and soaring, now dying on the ground. Nothing to hold it, nowhere to go. Just down to the marshes to lie and grow.
And how did this one come about?
Well, it came about because when I was working at the Center for Doc Studies at Duke, the person who was kind of, what do you call it, the greeter at the door, who sits there,
yeah.
who sits and lets people in and says where to go and stuff like that. What do they call those people?
A docent or something?
No, it's like... The greeter person.
Okay, the greeter. They call him the greeter.
My God.
I'm no better at pulling words out than you are.
It's like you sit there and when somebody comes in, you say, okay, he's on fourth floor, blah, blah, blah. And
yeah,
you can take a left and go down here. The bathrooms are here, you know. Anyway, he was that person. And his name was Mike Taylor. And he would just sit there reading, you know. And oh, actually, no, that wasn't at all. he was in a folklore class at UNC at the time. And he was, and as part of his course, when he heard I was going to be at Duke, he asked to be my student assistant. So how I met him. And it was great because I didn't realize to what extent a musician he was. I knew he played music, but I had never really heard him. And he guided me through, you know, you got to have a civil, you have to make a syllabus.
A syllabus, yeah.
Yeah. What do you, and I would say, what's a syllabus? So he would kind of guide me through all that part of the stuff I had to do. And it was fabulous. And, then we became friends. And he said one time, he said, you know, I would like to produce a record of you. And so I talked to him about it, and it seemed like it might be fun to do. And so we did. You know, he'd come over to the house and sit in the kitchen. I'd play stuff for him that I thought might be good. And he'd say, yeah, that'd be great. And then he put together this band. And, you know, it was really a great experience for me.
It's a marvelous record. I really love it.
I'm glad you like it. Yeah, it was a lot of, I wouldn't have thought to put together that kind of a band necessarily, but he sort of heard something and I'm glad he did. I mean, one of, you know, I like all that stuff too.
Well, Alice Gerard has written a book. It's called Custom Made Woman, A Life in Traditional Music. And it's a wonderful book with a zillion beautiful pictures in it, including pictures of my Aunt Joan.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you not only for writing this great book, but for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Absolutely. It's really nice to meet you. And please give my love to Robin.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.